Newton and an atheist walk into a bar. I'm Neil Newton.
And I'm Phil Thompson. And in this scenario, I'm playing the Christian.
And I'm the atheist.
Yeah, well, you know, since we're not in a bar, since we're in the Matrix for these meetings, I'm drinking a beer in my hometown of Pittsburgh, PA, which is where I'm recording my part of the podcast. And the company is Cinderlands. And this is their Skydog IPA. I bought it solely because it had a picture of a Les Paul guitar outlined. And it appears that, you probably can't see this in my camera. I'll hold it up here. It appears that the headstock is smoking a cigarette, which I
has a cigarette.
I also find kind of intriguing. This is the
It's a common place for guitarists who smoke to keep their cigarette while they play.
That's really interesting.
Famously, Slash would do it.
Slash would do it. I kind of think, did Eddie Van Halen do that too?
He might. He played a Kramer guitar back in the day, at least.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't quite the same space to put the cigarette butt in.
Well, at least the iconography doesn't match. Yeah.
So I'm going to give this a try, see if I can get the my lapel mic to pick up the can opening. That's tasty. It's a it's got a little bit of citrusy flavor in it, but it's not overbearing. It's not like a summer beer.
I'm drinking the Lucky Luke Millwright Oatmeal Stout. And that is an oatmeal stout?
It is. That's a matter of fact.
I know, and it tastes very nice as well. It's very good. I prefer dark beers, so beers don't have seasons as far as I'm concerned. So we decided to make this podcast because, you know, we've been talking about a lot of things together over the years. We must have known each other for 8 years now, I think.
Yeah, probably.
You know, we've talked a lot of topics, and we have quite different backgrounds as far as beliefs go, although in other cases we have very similar backgrounds. But it's just interesting about how we find, especially on a lot of like moral issues and things like that, how we have very similar opinions despite you being a Christian and me being an atheist. So I thought it was a good opportunity to talk about how our backgrounds influence our decisions in different ways, but we come to the same understanding.
And I guess we should say that we met in the back hallway of the music building at Pitt, where you were, when you were a lecturer in music theory, and I was, as I continue to be, the concerts and communications coordinator for the Department of Music there. And we were neighbors, office neighbors, and got to know each other and became friends. And our love for music, but also a love for sports and a love for talking about politics and eventually talking about theology and philosophy. And found that we had a lot in common despite having very different belief systems.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And yeah, I remember the first time realizing this actually was I probably hadn't been in the department that long, and I just mentioned something to you, and mentioned it was on. I just said, "Oh well, on the Daily Kos website, it says I can't remember what," and you just carried on talking like you knew exactly what I was talking about. There was no question of what is the Daily Kos or anything like that.
right.
And I was like, oh, this person has a very similar viewpoint to me.
Right. And at the time I was reading Daily Kos a lot.
That's right. I mean, I don't tend to read the Daily Kos very much myself anymore either.
The election of Trump kind of ruined it for me because they were so certain that he was not going to win. And so that ruined it.
I think that was similar for me as well.
It made it hard for me to go back and, you know, have confidence. Although, you know, it's still a good resource for opinion and gathering information from a lot of different sources. But anyway, enough about Daily Kos. but we've known each other for a long time. We've talked about a lot of things and been able to find a lot of common ground. And so I guess the idea is that we would have some of the conversations that we were having together, mm-hmm. which we found mutually beneficial, and
right.
put them in a place where other people could hear them and participate in them and maybe find them beneficial or maybe not.
Yeah, that's right. And then also I think there's like the added benefit of like just the process of finding common ground, you know, especially in like a current climate of so much division and things like that, you know, that realizing that common ground is probably more important than the different ground.
Yeah. And how do we get there and how do we find it? And does having, say, a different religion or a different political party make it impossible for you to hear and understand each other?
Exactly.
And I guess a lot of times the answer is, yeah, it does. But I think that we're saying, no, it does not have to.
It doesn't have to. And even in times it does, the viewpoint can be so similar that the differences become irrelevant in many ways. You know, you just arrived at that same viewpoint from a different angle. And
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So a good thing to do now is maybe like we'll just, you know, because it's the first episode, maybe we should just explore how we came to be, like our belief systems came to be a little closer. So, you know, we've known each other so long, but we don't know much about each other's backgrounds in many ways. So I know you grew up in a religious family.
My parents were both very committed Christians. I shouldn't speak about them both in the past tense. My dad's still alive, although he's in an elder care facility and had a major stroke a few years back. But both my parents were very committed Christians. And he's hanging in there. He's like, he's as healthy as he can be right now in the pandemic. I shouldn't just throw that out there and not say, any more about it. They both grew up in what are known as the Plymouth Brethren Assemblies, which is a very small denomination. If you read Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon Days, he talks about growing up in Plymouth Brethren Assemblies. And there are a couple key characteristics. One is it's all lay leadership.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are no professional clergy. Although they expect lay people to be very serious about studying the Bible and reading books about theology so that they can lead. One of the other key elements to Plymouth Brethren is that it was kind of the platform through which dispensationalism came into American evangelical theology. And dispensationalism, for those who aren't familiar with the term,
and I'm not.
That's when you hear about the Left Behind series of books or videos or the Rapture, the idea that the church is taken away from the tribulation by Jesus, mm-hmm. and taken to heaven while the tribulation is going on is like a key part of dispensationalism. And they're actually different, even like different views on that. But the idea of the rapture kind of comes from dispensationalism.
I see. And I guess with the lay preachers, it's dispensation, not compensation.
Exactly. there's very little compensation. We grew up mostly in Baptist churches in the Baltimore area, either Southern Baptist or Independent Baptist churches. And it was very strict. I would call it, saying it in a pejorative way, a fundamentalist background. And I did learn a lot of things from that. I learned I learned to take the Bible really seriously. I read the Bible a lot, even from a young age. And, you know, so I know what is in the Bible,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe more than is even good for me. and the other thing that kind of moved me in the direction that I moved in terms of my faith journey was music. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in a household where music was really important. My mother was a very good classically trained pianist. She had wanted to go to Wheaton Conservatory, which is one of the few Christian colleges in the United States that has a really professional level conservatory of music attached to it. But there just wasn't enough. You know, she grew up in a working class family in Baltimore, and there just wasn't enough money to do that. So she went and got a degree in elementary education, and that's what she did for her career. But music was very important, and we would hear concerts at church or through the church. And one of the things that got me completely hooked on music was hearing the musician, the trombonist, Bill Pierce, who was the bass in a group called the Melody Four Quartet. They were a gospel quartet, and they would, you know, travel around and perform and record. And, you know, this would have been in the early 70s when I was,
What type of
just a wee lad.
What type of quartet is this? Like, so it's a gospel quartet, but is he playing trumpet?
It's a vocal quartet. It's a vocal
quartet.
He would sing as the bass in the vocal quartet, but then he would do trombone solos as part of the act. And he was a very good bass vocalist, but he was a phenomenal trombone player. In fact, he was considered on the level with jazz players like Irby Green and Bill Watrous, and had during World War II had played in the Jimmy Dorsey band, or I rather had played in one of the army bands in World War II and had played in the Jimmy Dorsey band. Either before or after the war, I can't recall. And then the other influence for me musically is that I really got into classical music, and I got into classical music through Charles Schulz and the Peanuts, because Schroeder was my favorite character. Beethoven on his toy piano. I really liked him because he loved music, but he also was a baseball player, and he was, you know, the catcher and that kind of thing.
So were you a catcher?
I was a pitcher, but I respected that Schroeder was a catcher because he had a very workmanlike attitude.
And I guess the catcher is as the pitcher is your kind of primary teammate in many ways, right?
Right.
So he seemed like an ally.
He seemed like an ally, yeah, in many ways. You know, so when I told my mom that I wanted to listen to the music of Beethoven, she was thrilled. You know, mm-hmm. She was over the moon, and she had all of these albums of Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, and because she was an educator, you know, she understood that, you know, I should listen to the 1812 Overture, you know, the album with the live cannon fire that they recorded and overdubbed, which was very exciting. You know, so that got me into classical music, and that combined in that I decided at some point after studying trombone and becoming very serious about it, I really decided I wanted to be an orchestral trombonist. And so I was listening to a lot of Mahler and Bruckner and Wagner, all the things with the big trombone parts. Mm-hmm. And why that's important is because it was listening to instrumental music, you know, music without any words whatsoever, that got me to thinking that it was listening to instrumental music that kind of pushed me away from thinking about music in the way that my religious experience had taught me to think about music growing up, because music was fine in that kind of environment as long as you were like preaching the gospel or ministering, you know, but otherwise, you know, it wasn't seen as really a valid vocation. And my experience of the orchestral repertoire was how deeply music spoke to me mm-hmm. without having any didactic meaning. And that was one of the things that made me start moving toward, just a different way of understanding Christian faith.
Sure, sure. So, the faith and the music are very tied up for you and this idea.
Yeah, they're very interesting. They're very intertwined.
Interesting. It seems like what people might call more abstract music is what kind of grabs you towards that.
Yeah, for sure. I felt very spiritually alive when I was playing orchestral music, when I was listening to orchestral music, when I was making all kinds of music, really. Mm-hmm. But mainly those were my interests. And, you know, so I knew there was something more to the importance of music than whether you could, you know, slap gospel lyrics on it.
Yeah.
You know, and then I went to Oberlin Conservatory, actually to study composition by the time I was going to college, although I was still playing the trombone. I met campus ministers there and had a church community there and a Christian community that gave me the kind of broader perspective that helped me understand the value of music and art from the perspective of my faith. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes called reformational thought, and it sort of comes out of the Dutch neo-Calvinist school from the late 19th century, and with names like Abraham Kuyper and Herman Dooyeweerd. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I started thinking about faith in terms of having a Christian perspective about all areas of life, not just about, you know, what are considered moral issues or specifically quote unquote spiritual issues.
Sure.
And that really helped me. And it helped me become, I mean, it's probably one of the reasons I remained a Christian is that I was able to find a way of thinking about the Christian faith and about the Bible and about my art that held together.
Yeah, sure. It sounds like it became more of like a lived experience, like something that you could experience daily by having these, by tying everything to it.
Yeah, it just, it very aggressively kind of got rid of the dualisms between
sure.
your engagement in the world and your engagement with matters of faith. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful to me. And actually, honestly, it continues to be very helpful to me.
Yeah, you know, and that's an interesting thing. It's like, you know, as someone who studied music theory, you know, taught and published on music theory, something where music theory lost its shine for me for a while was its inability to engage with other things. Like, music theory does not relate to things I felt very passionate about, like prisoners' rights or something like that. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. they don't connect. And it's only, you know, recently that I've found ways to connect, and it's not connecting, it's not finding where music theory works and prisoner rights or things, but just that I have an underlying ontology that connects both. And because mm-hmm. of that ontology, I can say things in music theory which I think are politically relevant elsewhere.
Interesting.
So yeah, I understand that, like how that it re-energizes things. It can like re-energize things that seem somewhat unconnected.
Well, and it keeps you from diminishing the value of things that don't seem to have a direct political, you know, action
right.
associated with them. And in difficult times, you can start to feel like, well, you know, why am I pursuing art when there are so many other more urgent things? And there are times when maybe that is the right response.
Question, yeah.
But in general, probably not, because then we start to forget the reason we're pursuing politics and justice and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you don't exactly. You don't want to become a totally utilitarian society, which is what happens if you start to like just focus on what you think matters.
Yeah,
like what's important. You start to, you know, yeah, things have to have a purpose or they don't happen, and there should be lots of purposeless things happening.
Yeah. So, like, yes. Well, I feel like I'm doing a good job on that many days.
I mean, this podcast is just one more.
Exactly, edition. Exactly. Purposelessness exemplified.
Yeah.
But what about you, Neil? How about your background? Were you an atheist for, you know, your entire life?
I was raised an atheist by atheist parents who My dad also had atheist parents. My mum had an atheist father and a Catholic mother. So there was, out of all four grandparents, just one that was one that wasn't an atheist. I don't know if any of them would use the term atheist as a thing. They just don't believe in a higher power, mm-hmm. you know. And so it was just, you know, it just never seemed to me, it was never part of my life to do that. And, you know, and there was like, and even to the point where there was a distrust of people that did, I remember that very strongly. Like, you know, in New Zealand, to identify as religious is not that common as it is in the United States. So I remember in, you know, in primary school, I just had one friend who identified as a Christian. And, you know, my parents were skeptical of their family, you know. that was part of that. They were, they
didn't want that, you know, religion to rub off on you.
Well, no, they thought that the idea, the way they approached it was, you know, like kind of like what they think they're better than us. They've got a heaven, you know, like that they get to go to and we don't go there.
Right.
Like, you know, and so that was the kind of approach. And it's like, you know, I imagine the Christian people would have been like, well, you can go to the heaven. Anyone can go there. And you just have to believe in it. And it's, and you know, my parents would be like, well, we don't believe in it. You know,
it's, right.
So we're not going, but you know, but there's kind of like a sense of insult in that this person does believe in it, and you're not going to go there, you know. So there was kind of like a sense of injustice in that. But yeah, I should say the other thing actually is, by in America, when I tell people that I was raised an atheist, people think I probably come from an academic family. Uh-huh. And, you know, or something like that, you know, like, or at least a like middle class family or something. But, you know, this was a working class family. Neither of my parents finished high school. None of my grandparents finished high school. So, you know, they went into, you know, pretty menial jobs. Like my mum has worked, she still works to this day as a carer in like, different types of places. She's worked in elder care and things like this, but just like not as a nurse, not with any authority, just as like someone who works in those places.
Right.
And my dad growing up was in the military. And again, like he was in the Air Force, but not as a pilot or anything like that, but was military police. So, you know, it was like, and that was essentially because he couldn't get into the police. Yeah, he could never pass the physical examination to get into the police. So, joined the military police instead. So, I mean, so there was no intellectual atheism there. It was just, you know, it was a cultural atheism that I grew up in part of. And then in high school, I don't think I had any friends who identified as Christians until when I was in my last year of high school. My parents separated, and we moved cities. We moved to my mum's grandparents, like the city there, and I started a new high school, and I was a musician, and I was looking to be in a band. And there was a band there that needed a musician, and they were a Christian punk band. So the Christian punk band had an atheist bassist.
Which is the most punk thing to be in a Christian punk band, the one atheist.
Yeah, yeah. And how many Christian punk bands had an atheist, you know? So it was a real punk band in that sense. Like, but yeah, that was, you know, so that was like when I first really came into contact with people who were outspoken in their religion, because they were of, you know, like they were Pentecostal, I believe, something like that. It was a church where they would go and they would speak in tongues, and they would have like guest speakers from America come over. And there's
wow.
A lot of like,
so they were really into it.
Yeah, I mean, if they're in America, I think they would have been charming snakes. You know, it was like it was the kind of that level, and it was so that you know, that was, and as you can imagine, with having, going to a place like that, they were very adamant they were going to convert me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and one of the things when people, when you have a belief and people come in like that and have a different belief and kind of, and they clash, as you start to develop your own individual belief system.
Yeah.
You know, to, you know, you start to, like, things you hadn't ever questioned, you start to question, and then you develop reasons why. And so that was really like when my kind of like my belief in atheism kind of became solidified, as, you know, was because I was in this Christian punk band. And you know, and it was, yeah, it was what, it was because my belief was questioned constantly.
Right, so, right. Which is not a hard time story. It is it is actually Neil's story, but it could be a hard time story.
It
I feel like.
It could be a hard time story. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, and other than that, the only contact I had religion was my grandmother growing up. Obviously, my mum's mother was Catholic, but she had a very fraught relationship with Catholicism anyway, because she was unquestioningly Catholic. Mm-hmm. Like, I never once heard her, like, despite being in a family of atheists, I never once heard her doubt it. We never questioned her. It was just an accepted thing. Mm-hmm. You know, she grew up in an orphanage, actually, brought up by nuns, but the nuns were abusive because, you know, like, Catholic orphanages often were in the 30s. Mm-hmm. You know, and she was there because of Catholicism, and, you know, in a way, because she came from a Catholic family. And she found this out later when, you know, she met her mum not long before her mother died, I think like 3 or 4 months before her mother died. My great-grandmother came from this Catholic family, had a child out of wedlock.
Oh,
and so she had to give it up to for adoption. So that, you know, so that was how my grandmother came to be in the orphanage. And then the orphanage wasn't good. So there was always this kind of, like, you know, slightly tense relationship with Catholicism, you know, even though she never questioned it. Yeah. So that was, you know, that was with her, and, you know, and she was in many ways the, my closest family member growing up as well. I got along with her very well. So when she would go to church, I'd often go along with her and things like that, you know. And to me, church was just a fun place where people sang songs, and, you know, like, I didn't think it was about anything. It just seemed like I was young, like, maybe, like, I would have stopped going about the age of 6. So, like, what the priest said had no meaning to me.
Right.
You know, it was just something that my grandmother went to. It was like a club she was a part of, is how it seemed to me. Yeah, I mean, that was essentially it. I mean, as far as religion goes, it was, or, you know, even like non-belief in religion, it wasn't active until that last year of high school when,
yeah,
I was in that when I was in that Christian punk band, and that's when I really kind of developed it. And that's actually, I think, good, like, model for thinking about this podcast, actually, because that, you know, like, teenagers with their beliefs kind of trying to force them upon each other is kind of like opposite of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I think something that has struck me about you, you're not a preachy atheist. And when I think of a preachy atheist, I think of, like, you know, Neil Peart lyrics or something like that.
sure.
You know,
or Richard Dawkins or Ricky Gervais,
right,
or something,
yeah,
like that. Yeah, which neither of who I like.
Right. How did you become an atheist? Like, at the beginning, you talked about our belief systems, and it seems very clear in your mind that your atheism is a belief system and not, like, objective fact.
Well, I actually think you can't say there is no God. And I say that with, like, a full understanding. Well, not a full, no one has a full understanding of science,
sure,
but a very rigorous understanding of science is that I know there's enough questions in science that leave spaces for things to exist.
Right.
We don't even know how many dimensions there are, you know, so, like, we know.
Right.
So there is space for things, but my lived experience is that it's irrelevant. Like, that if there is something, it is not relevant to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the kind of that really kind of defines that to me. So when it's I mean I'm calling it a belief system, but it's not so much a belief system as just a, like, I don't think it shapes my view of the world in any way of whether a God existed or a God did not exist. You know, that's irrelevant to the choices I make and the decisions I make. So it's almost in many ways an Occam's razor approach, you know, and I don't necessarily like Occam's razor as a you know, a rule of thumb, but you know, it's like, but if something is irrelevant, then I'm just going to put it aside. Right. I'm not going to worry about it too much. And you know, and so the easiest thing is I'm never going to believe that a God exists. So, you know, as long as things stay as they are, which they have for, you know, like written history, you know, as, you know, as far as I've seen, you know, so I don't see anything changing that would ever make me think a God existed. So it's like, you know, you might be aware of Russell's teapot as a as a religious argument. So it's Bertrand Russell's argument where and he also, I mean, in many ways, like, he had similar ideas to what I have, whereas he was like, I can't remember the quote exactly, but something lines of that when he talks to an everyday person and they ask him what he believes, he says he's an atheist. When he talks to a philosopher, he says he's agnostic. You know, like, yeah. because you know, it was essentially atheism, when he felt he was talking amongst his peers, that they knew that what he would mean by agnosticism. One of the things he said about religion was that the burden of proof is on religious people to prove there is a God, not on atheists to prove there is not a God. Mm-hmm. And his whole thing was, so Russell's teapot was, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, imagine that orbiting the earth or floating through space or whatever, there is a microscopic teapot. Who is the burden of proof on to say that the teapot exists? You know, we don't just assume it exists. You have to like show that it exists. And so he was saying, like, in the same way, if there is a God, you have to show that it exists, you rather than disprove it. You could never disprove the teapot isn't there. That would be impossible.
Right.
Where it comes down to not being a preachy atheist is that just because I don't see evidence doesn't mean another person doesn't see evidence. You know, I'm not going to project my experience of the world onto other people. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the thing, like, people like Richard Dawkins or Ricky Gervais or any number of these kind of current celebrity atheists,
Bill Maher,
in the last few decades, is that they also see a belief in religion as being a sign of intellectual stupidity or some type of, you know, some type of sign that the person is not thinking clearly and properly. And that to me is just, you know, just outright insulting. Like,
yes, yes it is. but it's the same, I think, when a religious person has that same attitude toward an atheist, which I've certainly come across. But especially, you know, in my experience, Christians feeling simultaneously threatened, but also feeling somehow smugly superior. And you know, it's something that has come up that we've talked about a number of times, is that any belief system can swerve into fundamentalism.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And that might be something that we talk about, you know, in more detail in the future, so...
Yeah, and that, you know, there's been very like naive things stated by, like, I remember seeing, it was on Colbert's show, when Ricky Gervais was on it being interviewed. This was not the Colbert Report. This is his David Letterman show.
The late night show. Yeah,
And they were talking about, because, you know, Colbert is a Catholic, and they were talking about this, and Ricky Gervais said to Stephen Colbert, well, you know, One of the main differences between religion and science is if you burned all the books, got rid of everything today, and then society grew back, he's like, the science books would all be the same, but the religious texts wouldn't. And Stephen Colbert agreed, and I thought, like, as an atheist, that's fundamentally wrong. Like the science books would not be the same.
Right,
like,
no.
You know, to think that that science is not like, or the order we find things out, even if you do believe in an objective science, which I don't strongly, but you know, even if you did, the order that we found things out would be different, which would influence the way we think about other things we find out. Like the science books would come back incredibly different.
Right, like, right. You know, and that's, yeah.
It's just a misunderstanding of science.
It's a very popular misunderstanding of science, and it's science as, you know, kind of taking on the role of religion in a lot of ways as immutable truth, almost, as
exactly,
opposed
exactly.
to
they're taking science as a replacement for religion, and in my beliefs, which like non-religious, I don't want anything to take the place of religion. I don't want science to take the place of religion. I don't want economics to take the place of religion. I don't want humanism. I don't want anything to like to take that
right, yeah.
to take that kind of like defining place. And science, of course, is best understood as a dialogue anyway. You know, it's like nothing is ever proven. It's just a theory that, you know, hasn't yet been disproven, and that's like a structure of dialogue between scientists, not immutable truths.
Right, right, yeah. Well, which is, you know, something that Thomas Kuhn, you know, developed at length in, you know, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's one theoretical paradigm gets replaced. A theoretical paradigm gets replaced when it fails. You know, when they're just when it builds up too many anomalies.
And the person I take a lot of it from is Karl Popper, who was like that, you know, science, as you know, for something to be scientific, it has to be falsifiable.
Right.
And that's not that it has been falsified, but that it could be. There's a way
exactly.
to do it.
Exactly.
Like gravity, for example, we've never falsified gravity, but we know how we could. We know if we held a ball up and dropped it and the ball floated, then we'd say, oh, well, that falsifies gravity.
Right.
Just the fact that we haven't doesn't mean it's non-falsified.
Right, right.
It's
right.
just we know how to, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, these are all maybe topics. Future topics, preview of coming attractions. Yeah, and I think one of the reasons that we've always been able to have these kind of productive conversations is a value of trying to respect the other person regardless of what their beliefs are.
Exactly, exactly. And finding that the points of connection rather than points of difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's become more and more important to me, especially as we've gone through this very fraught, you know, political time, and you hear people talking almost glibly about how we can't talk to each other across our different communities or our different convictions, and although empirically it's true, it bothers me. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, you know, as a Christian, I've been thinking about a lot about a theological concept that's known as common grace.
Uh-huh.
Or it's sometimes called general revelation, but I like common grace a lot as a way of describing it. And it's simply the idea that we are all made in God's image. So we all have access to similar ways of experiencing God's creation.
Sure.
And regardless of what our specific religious commitment is, we're still all in this world together. And we, you know, so I can see that as a Christian and say, I have absolute confidence that someone who does not share my beliefs as a Christian is going to be able to contribute to the political and the scientific and the social structures of our world in productive ways. And we're going to come to similar conclusions on a lot of issues, you know, if I'm willing to hear it, because of that. And because of that shared experience of the world, which is a core part of my theology, right?
We all have the same starting point for you. So there's going to, because of that shared starting point and all the things that come with that, we're going to be able to find connections with each other on things. There's going to be some things which we naturally just come about the same way as each other.
Right. And I think it's so important, you know, because we experience, and I would say many people who call themselves Christians, whether they acknowledge it or not, acknowledge common grace in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, like if I need to see a cardiologist and my cardiologist is a Hindu, I don't care. As long as she's a good cardiologist, you know. And, you know, similarly, like in a, you know, if the inside linebacker on my favorite football team is a Muslim, I don't care as long as he's a good inside linebacker. We're talking American football linebacker. or if my auto mechanic is an atheist, I don't care as long as he fixes my car and doesn't rip me off. You know, so we acknowledge common grace in all of these ways all the time, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And yet a lot of times when we come to like the political sphere or social structures or, you know, family structures or things like that, you know, we're not willing to listen to people who are like outside of our tribe. And that's a huge problem. And for me as a Christian, like pushing this humble but sadly disregarded doctrine of common grace has been a way of saying, like, this is, we do share these commonalities. This is a way for us to engage constructively in public dialogue as Christians without trying to impose our specific framework, a specific theological framework on anyone else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah. And it's like almost seems like the reliance that other people have this shared experience, this common grace, is also like another act of faith in many ways. That these people that might appear quite different to you have the same seed is like, you know, is an act of faith.
Yeah, and I would say in a certain extent, you're never operating in a belief neutral environment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, which is why it intrigues me that you talk about belief system, and maybe you're just trying to help me and reach out to me when you talk about atheism as a belief system. But like,
well, atheism
and actually,
is a belief system.
It is a belief system.
It's a belief that there is no God. I mean,
yeah. You know, so when people say some things, you know, when people say something like, you know, miracles are things that happen which science has not yet explained. Well, that's non-falsifiable. That's a belief that you're articulating, you know, not an actual kind of demonstrable scientific fact. Well, I've been saying to people a lot, like, I don't care how you get a demonstrable fact,
mm-hmm.
you know, as long as you get there.
That's right. Is the idea that there are things that science hasn't yet explained and that science will eventually explain everything is, like you say, completely non-scientific. Because you can't prove that science will eventually explain everything. You can't disprove it, you know, because it's given infinite time, you know, how could you prove that?
Right.
If you were to take a hard science approach anyway, you would be like, well, the universe has a life before it kind of freezes to death, you know, as everything gets too distant. So there is an infinite time. So that now you've got to prove that science will know everything before that time runs out, you know?
Right.
So your job becomes harder.
Yeah, you don't want to put that off too long.
this idea of common grace is interesting because I have a similar view, but it comes from a different angle. It does actually come from a theological philosopher, but he's read widely by atheist philosophers as well, and that is Immanuel Levinas. But he bases his idea of morals on what he calls the this idea of the other. When you come face to face with another person or even like a cat or a dog or something, but he's more specifically talking about people, you recognize there's someone else there. So you know you exist. You have your kind of thoughts. You have your stuff that happens inside you. And you have your agency and your desires and things, and you see this other person, and when you see them, you recognize that they also exist, you know, that mm-hmm. you, mm-hmm. that they have their own, they are the same as you. You recognize that kind of similarity between each other, but then you also realize that there is this difference between you, that they have their own set of desires and things. And so to him, he saw that as that was his definition of God, essentially, was the recognition of the other. I don't see it as a definition of God, but I see it as like I can see why he wanted to use that as kind of like a kind of first truth to build his moral philosophy off of, because the idea that we come into contact with people and we recognize that they are also people, you know, we see that similarity, but we also see that they are individuals, you know, so we have to respect that individuality, and we have to understand that, you know, they are just another version of us. And you know, and so that's kind of, I think, like, it works in a very similar way to your common grace, that, you know, it's that kind of recognition of, like, they are another version of me, essentially. You know,
yes.
But then, yeah. And to them, I'm another version of them. You know, like, it's right. A very decentered way of kind of saying, like, we are all the same, but we are all different.
Right, and it keys in on the idea of empathy, which mm-hmm. Which I think is foundational to you know, any kind of moral formulation. In the Bible is foundational to any moral formulation. And I do come across, you know, theologians and pastors who don't like the idea of empathy as being, you know, kind of moral foundation. You know, a lot of, over the centuries, a lot of Platonic Greek categories slid into Christian theology. I mean, even uh-huh. like really from the second century.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's this tendency to want to talk about, you know, for instance, morality as being about timeless truths. And theology is like the discovery of timeless truths, but the Bible doesn't really talk about it that way. The Bible will talk about God as being unchanging. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't talk, when it gets to morality, it starts with empathy. You know, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart is part one, and love your neighbor as yourself is part two. Mm-hmm. You know, and part two has that kind of two-pronged thing, and that the assumption is that because you understand that you are created in God's image and are loved by God, you then have the power and the agency and also the obligation to love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, and Jesus reiterates that when he's asked, what are the most important commandments in the Gospels? Jesus goes back to, well, the two greatest commandments are love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And he amplifies it, and he says, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. Like, everything hangs on that. And the core of that is, the core of at least the part two of that is empathy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Seeing yourself, like Livernus is saying, seeing yourself in the other.
Yeah, 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 exactly, yeah. And that, and he goes further where he says that when you look at the other and you recognize them as being the same as you, but independent, that in that act of recognition, you can do them no harm at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, so I mean, yeah. And if I think that's the case, if you have like that kind of view of empathy and that view of like really kind of like acknowledging the other person, it is very, very difficult to do them harm.
Yeah, 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 I think the only, and I feel like that's something that a lot of people can agree about, and again get to that point from a lot of different ways. For me, there's an internal process for me to be truly empathetic. I feel I need to be transformed internally, at the core of my being. You know, so to live into that, that law of loving God with your whole heart and loving your neighbor as yourself requires me to confront and to have help confronting and dealing with, you know, the things that I'm terrified of most in my own being, you know. So that's something that I too have been thinking about a lot, you know. So, you know, because when I think, well, Phil, what is different about what you're saying, you know, and maybe there isn't anything substantially different, but my own sense of need to be, you know, healed and transformed in my inner being so that I can do those things is where it comes, you know, full circle into, you know, being a Christian and being a follower of Jesus.
The interesting point of difference that I have is that to me it's incredibly important that comes from me, I am the active thing in accepting other people and creating this empathy that it wasn't placed there from elsewhere is important to me, you know. That's kind of like at some level I'm the source of this, just this one small version of it. I am the source of that, and there's many other sources that are also doing the same thing. So yeah, to me that it's coming from individuals creating a community, to me is more powerful to me, it's more powerful and more binding, I think, than if it comes from an external source.
So this is a segment that we call Should I Really Care About This? Should I Really
Care About This? And this week we were thinking of looking at VAR or VAR or
instant replay in sports,
or the third umpire, or whatever it's called in the multiple different sports,
and why we like it and why we hate it.
Yeah,
should we start with why we hate it?
I mean, I have way more reasons why I hate it than why I like it. So maybe we should start with why I like it.
Okay, go ahead.
Or why I thought it would be good. It started in cricket in 1992, and I'm a big cricket fan, and I've always found it good in cricket. You know, like there's a lot of calls in cricket where you could objectively say something happened or didn't happen, and the umpire couldn't always spot it. And then it would be shown on the replay, and you'd be like, oh, they gave that person out, and he was clearly in. This is ridiculous. And it worked in cricket, and I think that's why cricket was such an early adopter. Now, what are we talking, like 30 years later almost, it's popped up in soccer, which I care about far more than cricket, and I wanted it. I wanted it in soccer. I'd seen enough times. Like I remember a case maybe like the season before VAR was introduced in the Premier League where Liverpool scored a goal against West Ham and James Milner was at least 6 yards offside. And it was just like, this is ridiculous. You can see this with the naked eye. But he was so far offside that the referee hadn't really taken him into account, or the linesman hadn't taken him into account, because he was outside of his field of vision. That's how offside he was. You know, if the linesman's looking down the line and he's well past the line, and there was a goal, and it was just, you know, this is the most absurd thing ever. And you're watching that and you're thinking like, this shouldn't happen. You know, they should be able to look back at this and say, he's clearly offside, and this, you know, and we're not going to give that as a goal. You know, so that's what I wanted from it, is I wanted it to be able to spot those clear and obvious mistakes.
Yeah.
And then what has happened instead is they've gone for just the minutiae. They've gone for the smallest thing, like someone being, you know, someone's sleeve being offside when they've scored a goal or something like that. Something that, that is, and they're trying to make everything objective, you know, rather than saying this is this, there is interpretation in this game. And sometimes things are so obvious that there is no room for interpretation, but other things there are interpretation. They've just said everything is objective.
Right, right. Yeah.
And that's what's destroying it for me.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess what I like about instant replay, you know, it started in 2010, and I remember it really distinctly because I was actually at a composer's workshop in the summer.
Is this in American football?
In baseball.
And baseball.
A Detroit Tigers pitcher, Armando Galarraga, was pitching a perfect game, and there was a ground ball to first base that would have ended the game, and the runner was out by a mile, and the umpire inexplicably called the runner safe. You know, and a perfect game is that rarest of rare things in baseball. You know, the umpire apologized afterwards, but there was no way in the rules that the umpires could confer and say, yeah, that was the wrong call. He was clearly out. You know, and so that brought instant replay in gradually into baseball, and it came in into football, and of course, like you're saying, in what the rest of the world calls football, and
which I'm politely referring to as soccer. Yeah.
Yes, that's very thoughtful of you, and hockey, and you know, but you know, like your example of the Liverpool West Ham game, and I remember in the 2017 Stanley Cup when the Pittsburgh Penguins were playing Nashville. Mm-hmm. And in game one, Nashville scored first, and the goal was called off because of offsides, and it was on appeal, you know. And so they were showing this appeal, like, when did the puck cross the blue line? When did the player's skate cross the blue line? Mm-hmm. And even in super slow motion, it was so hard to see.
Yeah.
And that's when it became really obvious to me, like, this is not actually objective in any meaningful sense because it's so beyond the human scale of perception. Like, it's kind of a fake objectivity because it's beyond the scale of human perception,
and
you know,
often beyond the scale of perception of the camera even.
Right. Like,
yeah.
Or the pixels, you know,
the pixels. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and it's occurred to me that the only proper way to do it is in real time, you know, in other words, you're not allowed to slow it down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you have like 30 seconds to look at it.
Exactly. I think exactly the same thing with soccer. When they start getting out the lines and drawing lines.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That drives me crazy.
It's like, no, go with what the linesman said.
Right. And those VAR lines, you know, for instance, in Premier League, are way beyond the capacity for human perception. I mean, if you're a
and I think they're beyond the capacity of the official that's sitting in front of the computer, because they're not drawing them perfectly on the people, and the football itself is blurred as the player kicks it because it's moving so fast from frame to frame. You can't actually tell the exact frame that they kicked it, and then you can't pick the exact pixel that the person is
it has this sheen of objectivity to it,
but it's fake. Yeah,
but it's really more fake and more removed from our experience than you can. So I mean, I think we've come to a shared conclusion on this, that the only way to do instant replay or VAR, you know, properly is that the referee has to watch it in real time and has a very small window. Because if you can't see it in real time in 30 seconds, then the call was right.
Yeah, the call was right. Exactly. Just and it returns some type of agency to the linesmen, the people on the field who are making decisions. You know, right. like at the moment, they're kind of like the referee has importance in soccer, but the linesmen, you know, on the sidelines, who used to do the offsides and stuff, have very little importance. You know, because they know that everything they say is going to be double checked.
And they wait, like they wait till the play is over, even when it's obviously offsides.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
you know, which is not, I don't think, a good effect on the game. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that's right. They're definitely in agreement. Just go to the point where a human can see it in real time, and if a human can't see it in real time, then move on. Go with the original decision.
Right. And so I think that brings us to our question for this segment. Should I really care about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. You should absolutely care about this. We do.